You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as the anniversary of the Peshtigo fire approaches, we talk with a woman who brings her great-grandmother's memories of the tragedy to life.
First, a new bill would eliminate state protections for wetlands that aren't protected by the federal government. The bill could affect about 1 million acres of wetlands in the state. This proposal comes as President Trump's administration is moving to pull back federal environmental protections.
Roger Roth is one of the backers of the wetlands bill. He's a Republican state senator from Appleton. He's also the Senate president. Senator Roth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, first of all, what is current law when it comes to wetlands and development here in Wisconsin?
Well, if you look at the proposal that Representative Steinecke and I are putting out there right now, on the front end, nothing changes under our bill from current law. The DNR still must come to the site. They still have to determine if the wetland is a federal wetland, an isolated non-federal wetland, or an artificial wetland. If the DNR determines at that, when they come out to the site, that it is a federal wetland, which is the vast majority of all wetlands in our state, 80 to 90% of all wetlands people will see in our state, those are federal wetlands, nothing changes because those are regulated by the federal government, by the Army Corps of Engineers. If it's determined that it's an isolated non-federal wetland, well, those currently are not subject to federal regulation, and therefore under our bill they're not going to be required or subject to state regulation either. This is an area where Wisconsin is one of the regulatory outliers. I'm only aware of two other states, Indiana and Ohio, that regulate isolated non-federal wetlands. And under this bill, we won't either. But we still will require, and this is the important piece, we still will require that you mitigate for any isolated non-federal wetland that you fill in. And I think that's the important thing. And for your listeners, mitigation means, you know, if you are creating a development, a residential development or a business development, maybe you have a spot, an isolated non-federal wetland. To mitigate, that means that the DNR will let you fill that in, but in place of doing that, they're going to require that you mitigate that or create another wetland at a higher ratio, anywhere between 1.2 and 1.7 to 1, somewhere else within the watershed or the state. So it's important for everyone to know that under this bill, there is no net loss of wetlands here in the state of Wisconsin.
What problem do you see the current law causing? Because people might hear this and say, oh, Wisconsin's great, it has a higher standard than the rest of the country. What problems do you see that causing, though?
Well, currently, right now, we are out of balance between economic forces in our environment. And what we're looking to do is to help our landowners and to help our builders and our developers and make sure that there is an undue excess burden coming from the state of Wisconsin. We are one of those regulatory outliers. We are one of that I'm aware of only two other states that do this. And I think it's important that we take away the permitting process that they force you to go through, because of the growing season, many of the tests that they make you do, you can only do in what the growing season, which is typically spring to fall, so about 6 months of the year. And if you don't hit that right, it delays development anywhere from 12 to 18 months, and at that point, development goes elsewhere. So what this is trying to do is strike that proper balance, and it's trying to come into line with just about every other state in America. But at the end of the day, again, we still are requiring that mitigation. So people need to know that there will be no net loss of wetlands, and that's important to us. That was one of the things that we wanted to make sure is that we were being respectful of our environment, and I think you can see that we are doing that under this bill.
Talking to State Senator Roger Roth, Republican from Appleton, about new wetlands legislation he's sponsoring. Senator Roth, environmentalists might say, hey, Mother Nature does a better job building a wetland than humans do. Is that replacement wetland really going to be as good for us in terms of things like flood prevention, wildlife habitat, that sort of thing?
If we were talking about filling in federal wetlands, I would absolutely agree. The majority, 80 to 90% of all wetlands in our state, those are federal wetlands. Those are connected to navigable bodies of water. Those absolutely play a tremendous role when it comes to excess rainfall and flooding and so forth. The isolated non-federal wetlands that we're talking about here, it's important for listeners to recognize that when they picture a wetland in their mind, an isolated non-federal wetland, this isn't what they're thinking of. This isn't that pristine place where ducks and geese, their habitat. This is something completely different. And I've been to these farm fields where corn is growing right now, and the DNR says because of a particular soil indication here, this would be a wetland, but you would never see it. In fact, it could even be on top of a hill. So this is totally separate than the federal wetlands, and we just want to strike that proper balance between economic forces and our environment, and I think we've done that with this bill. And again, I have to hammer home the point that at the end of the day, there will be no net loss of wetlands in Wisconsin.
The original protections here had passed with bipartisan support, a Democratic Senate, but a Republican Assembly and Governor signing off on that. And I gather they viewed it as kind of urgent after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling said the feds don't have to protect these isolated wetlands. What's changed between then and now?
Well, I think you've seen... Now, I wasn't around in the legislature when they did that, but what I think you see now is that since only two other states that I'm aware of actually did what Wisconsin has done, we've been able to let this play out and recognize that whatever they were trying to accomplish back under Governor McCallum, that didn't play out. And what we have right now is all we've done is set the regulatory barrier so high that we are completely out of balance between those economic forces and the environment. And that's why I think now is the time for us to take a look at this.
What kind of response are you getting from colleagues in the legislature?
There's actually been a number of legislators. Representative Steinke and I have been working on this since the beginning of this year. But in our process of working on this and talking to other legislators, there are a number of them who are looking at this problem from different ways. And they've got bills that they had been working on for different facets of it. Representative Steinke and I determined that we wanted to do something that was more comprehensive and incorporated a lot of those. So people are hearing about it all over the state. I guarantee you, legislators from all over the state of Wisconsin are hearing about this in their districts, and they want to do something. They want to see the legislature step in here and strike that proper balance. So I feel pretty good about the support that we've got so far.
And what's your timeline for this?
Well, it's out for co-sponsorship right now. That closes at the end of the week, and when that's done, we'll introduce the bill here in the Senate, and it's just going to run through its normal course of legislative action. It'll have a hearing, it'll have an exec, and when that's done, I look to see if we can get it scheduled for a floor vote.
Senator Roth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Not a problem. Thank you.
That was Roger Roth, a Republican state senator from Appleton and the state Senate president. He joined us to talk about a new bill that he supports that would remove protections for certain wetlands in Wisconsin that aren't protected under federal law.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Some roads are easier to cross than others. One day, while crossing the busy, multi-lane Stoughton Road in Madison, Araceli Esparza was reminded of another crossing she'd made many times as a child with her grandmother. She shares a poem she wrote and tells us how and why it reminds her of Mexico.
Wild wheat of Stoughton Road. The abandoned wheel indicates this is an old road. The crushed wheat left by a mouse family says this is their home. An empty meal bag from the joint down the ways shows that this is a road on the other side of the tracks, on that side of town where the apartments are, where shopping happens in big blue box stores. Crushed cigarettes and an empty garbage bags tell of a family who left to find a shelter that would accept them, all of them. I have crossed many roads like this, and this ties in with my grandmother's. He would take me once a year, if not twice a year, down to Mexico on a 5-day bus ride, and so crossing the border. And so you have to get to Laredo, switch over to just a bus that will take you just across the border. And so you get a pretty intimate look of our U.S.-Mexican border crossing Laredo that way, especially on the bus, too. It's different than in a car because on the bus, you're a little bit elevated. So I could see people walking and on cars and just like all kinds of interactions happening. And a lot of times, they're just workers, you know, people working, going there 9 to 5. It seemed like a part of an everyday ritual, much like I was going crossing this, you know, Stoughton Road to my big blue box store to get something, whatever. You know, it just, that's a part of maybe a routine that I would have. And then just when I was crossing, I was thinking about crossing this other road. And when you're crossing the Rio Grande, it's like you're on a bridge and it's very open. It's just like Stoughton Road in that sense where it's like Like, you can almost imagine there was something there before, even. Just the landscape tells you that. And then just looking at the environment and just this particular corner and area, I was like, wow, you know. It's kind of like in the border where I could tell there were other things there before, and now there isn't. So, and that kind of the same people are crossing the road. Tall side fences remind me of the long fences of Laredo, of the never-ending cement groove that houses El Rio Bravo. I cross safely to the blue box store. If only every poor road was like this one, where one worries of distracted drivers and not sharpshooters. Yes, this is a road that crosses lots of cars and people, some brown, red, yellow, white, and black, all in a rush to buy bread. And going on the other side, right, from Mexico to the U.S., it's like what meets you right away is commercialism. So for me, it was like, yeah, I'm coming from one part, maybe of the part of this side of the tracks. When you're crossing on this side, the first things you see are, you know, all these logos, you know, and symbols. And so when I was crossing it, yeah, I was just like, wow, you know, but there's other things that are happening from my point of view, like the little mice, these bags that were left and just random objects. And you'll see that kind of litter too a little bit in the river, in El Rio Bravo, in the cement area. There's just all this litter and stuff. And you can see that people have either discarded things were left behind. But what are those stories too, right? Of these little passages that happened, and they happen in multitudes.
Araceli Esparza is a poet and teacher in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, on October 8th, 1871, a tremendous fire claimed up to 2,400 lives and destroyed 1.5 million acres of forest in northern Wisconsin and the upper and lower peninsulas of Michigan.
Known as the Peshtigo Fire, you would think that would be well known given the extent of the devastation, but in a weird coincidence, it happened on the very same day as another Midwest tragedy, the Great Chicago Fire.
Barbara Engelberg Chisholm is working to keep the memories and history of the Peshtigo Fire alive. She reenacts the history of the 1871 Peshtigo Fire by using the recollections of her great-grandmother, Emerence Gaspar Engelbert, and she'll be speaking at the Belgian Heritage Center in Brussels this Sunday. Barbara, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. I have been looking forward to doing this.
So what made you conceive of this idea to reenact this history using your grandmother's, your great-grandmother's memories?
I have always enjoyed history. My parents were very much into it. And I happened to stumble upon, when I got to a certain age and genealogy became important, I started looking into our history. And I discovered that my great-grandmother, indeed, and grandfather, did indeed survived the fire, and my grandfather lived with us, so he sort of perpetrated it and told me stories about them, which I found very interesting.
What kind of stories did you hear?
Oh, well, my great-grandmother and grandfather, actually my great-great-grandmother and great-great-grandfather also survived, but I only know the stories of my great-grandparents, happened to be waiting for the Kermis, which is a Belgian celebration, and they were looking forward to it, but they were watching the fires as it came closer and closer to where they were. And right at the last minute, the fires happened between 9 at night and about 3 in the morning, which made it doubly fearful. They decided that they weren't going anywhere, that they would have to stay and help save their buildings by taking pails of water and tossing it on their roof. But the fire got close enough that my great-grandfather told his wife to grab their child, who was 6 months old, and woolen blanket, and they were going down into a well. It was a hand-dug well on our property.
Wow.
which, by the way, was still there when I was growing up. So we were always told to stay away, that is where they went down. And as they did, the fire proceeded to come closer and closer, and go on either side and over them. They told Grandpa, my grandpa, stories about how terrible it was because they could hear the screams of the animals and the fire approaching, and everything just became one great big inferno.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And so it sounds like, I'm guessing, survived that ordeal. It must have been a long night. Do you know how long they spent down there?
Well, it was approximately, like I said, about nine at night till about 2-3 in the morning. But they stayed down there until early dawn, and then they proceeded to climb up out of the well. And I can, every time I say this, I tell people to just place themselves where these people were. They came out, and everything they had worked so hard for was gone. Their homes were gone, their barns were gone, their cattle were scattered, they had no more implements, and it was October and winter was coming. So what were they going to do? You know, it wasn't like today where you can call the Red Cross or the Salvation Army. They were completely unable to comprehend how they were going to survive. So it little by little, word did get out and provisions did start coming in. But for those initial, 3-4 days, I can't imagine. They had nowhere to go. They just stayed in that area and prayed.
And they weren't alone. That Peshtigo fire was so enormous, so far-reaching, that this was something many, many families were facing. Did you hear at all about how they survived and came back in the aftermath of so much destruction?
Well, there were different relief services set up. The government of Belgium actually sent $5,000 for its former citizens. And they set up relief areas in Green Bay and in Milwaukee. But there were strict provisions as to what they had to meet certain provisions in order to get this relief. They had to make sure that they were not given provisions if they met with trivial loss by the fire, such as burning fences. And the persons receiving aid, I'm quoting this, must not be allowed to eat the bread of idleness and where do not go to work upon their farms and refuse to work for compensation thereafter, all supplies shall be cut short. In other words, you weren't going to be just given those. You had to work for them. And by May of the following year, they were cut off from government help. The government said, that's it. This is all you're getting. You will now have to depend upon your own good right arms and go out and earn a living, which they did.
And they came back from it. So this is a story, when you think about this in terms of your family history, is this a story of resilience and, again, the triumph of what the human will can overcome? Or is this a story of destruction and sadness, or maybe both?
No, I would say it's a little bit of both, but you have to admire these people. They were, they came back, and over terrible odds, they gleaned a new living. They found out, they looked around, and they saw all these trees were burned, and so they thought, oh, okay, we came over from the old country to farm. Well, now we can farm because these trees are gone. We don't have to worry about them. We will build our houses of red brick, which was a way of saying, I am not going to have a fire come and burn our homes so fast. They will be made of red brick, and there's a lot of clay in the area, so red brick was a natural product of the clay, and they built their homes of that so that they would have a greater chance of surviving another fire if it happened to come. And they planted crops, and they prospered. And if you go into the southern part of the county now, you will still see a lot of these red brick homes. They survived a good many years and are still surviving.
Barbara, when you do your reenactment of your great-grandmother's memories of the Peshtigo fire, how do people respond? It's something that seems like it happened so long ago in Wisconsin history, and the way you tell it, the way you just told it, here on the radio with us, I could really sense and feel what it must have been like. How do people respond?
They respond very well. It's a subject that people, like you mentioned earlier, don't really realize. Some people, even in this county, do not. They say Peshtigo fire, they think it just happened on the other side of the bay. They say, oh, you mean it burned here also? Yes, it did. It did burn here, and it did affect lives of many, many people. I give this in the schools. And one little boy at one of the local schools, I asked if they had heard about the Peshtigo fire, and he raised his hand, and he says, oh, yes. He says, every October 8th at noon, we have a moment of silence because his particular relatives, some of them burned in the fire. And mm-hmm. so it was a day, a little time of remembrance. And teachers say, hey, they are really quiet when you're talking. They're really listening. So it's a very good subject, and people do enjoy hearing about it. I always have quite a nice turnout.
Oh, well, it's an incredible story, Barbara. Thank you so much for sharing it with us here today.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
That was Barbara Engelberg Chisholm, and she reenacts the history of the 1871 Peshtigo fire by using the recollections of her great-grandmother, Emerence Gaspar Engelbert. And you can find out about that presentation. It's going on this Sunday in Brussels, Wisconsin. You can visit BelgianHeritageCenter.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. It's the third day of our series, First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today. In today's edition, we're taking a look at politics.
Arvina Martin is in the studio with us now. She's the first Native American member of the Madison Common Council. She's a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Arvina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, when did you first know that you wanted to get into politics?
Apparently, I've been told that it happened when I was very young. My dad worked in politics, and apparently when I was four, I told people that what I wanted to be when I grew up, I wanted to be senator in the mornings and governor in the afternoons.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was a nerd back then, too.
And has that been consistent? I mean, that was early, but have you had an interest in politics ever since then?
I've always followed what's happening in our communities, whether it's local, state, nationwide. It's always been something that interests me and I've cared about.
And what roles have you played in the world of politics so far? Not having been governor and senator at the same time, quite yet.
No, I've not been governor nor senator. I just started my first term as an alder on the Madison Common Council that I was elected in April. So this is the first time I've actually run for office. But I've done a lot of volunteering for political campaigns, for candidates, for different causes. I'm on the board of NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin. So I do a lot of work for the pro-choice movement, and I've done a lot of work with the Democratic Party.
And what was your campaign like to become an alder?
It was very busy. I had a full-time job on top of it, so I would get done with work, go home, and either start making phone calls or go knock doors. There were lots of forums that we had to go to, so it was kind of like having two full-time jobs.
I think a lot of people might hear that and think, oh, not me. That doesn't sound like fun. And what would you say to them, to people who might be on the fence about running for, say, a local office?
I think it's a really good experience. I think it's really great to go out and talk to your neighbors and find out the things that are important to them. It makes you really think about what is important to the area in which you live and think about the people that you interact with all the time. And if you want to make a difference in their lives, it's a great way to do it.
And what issues are most important to you as a member of the Common Council in Madison?
Well, right now I'm kind of learning the ropes, I should say. So we're going through the budget season, and I'm learning as we go there. It's a lot of information, and I really like reading all these documents and listening to people. I am a member of the Food Policy Council, which is really cool, and working on addressing things like food deserts and making sure people have access to reasonably cost and healthy food.
It is a learning curve, isn't it? Because, I mean, I've reported on local government meetings in the past, and there's the way normal people talk, and then there's a way you have to translate into sort of government action and language.
It is. It's a bit different. Also, it's you really get to learn things like Robert's Rules of Order. I used to work in the State Assembly maybe about 15 years ago, and I thought, I know how legislative policy works, and you know the difference between the state legislature and Madison Common Council, it's pretty big.
We're talking to Arvina Martin, first Native American member of the Madison Common Council. She's a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. So you were sworn in mid-April of this year, mm-hmm. you're saying. What's come up so far as an alder? What kind of issues, expected or unexpected, have you seen?
Well, the big thing that we're working on right now is the development at the Hill Farm site where the DOT is. This is actually the largest development, single development in city history, from what I've been told. So it is a lot of work between listening to folks that live in the area and making sure that their voices are heard, as well as listening to what the developer wants to do and what their plans are, and trying to make sure that everybody's heard and everybody can be happy with what results.
Do you get a lot of calls from people in the neighborhood talking about that or just any issue? I think sometimes people, whenever they see a problem in the community, that common council person is their first point of contact.
Yeah, I get a lot of calls to my cell phone as well as to my house about issues, whether it is, you know, garbage pickup, potholes, stop signs, traffic concerns, you know, bus routes, etc., and definitely about the development at the Hill Farm site.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from the Native American community in Wisconsin since your election?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. It's something that, you know, it's not something that I've done by myself. It's I have to really rely on the people behind me as well. It's like, you know, people have laid the groundwork for things, and I have been able to work towards that as well. And I hope that, you know, I can help bring other people with me and a hand up, and, you know, so that they can pass me up and be governor or be senator. It'd be amazing.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, look at government and don't see that. They see their elected representative. It's a team sport, kind of.
Yes. And I think of the night that I was elected and my daughter was there and watching, and she was just like, she had participated in the campaign as much as an 8-year-old can. Mm-hmm. But that night she was like, "Mama, you won." Oh my gosh. And there were, you know, little girl relatives of mine who were there, and my nieces that were there, and they were like, "Oh my gosh, this has happened." And I could see that reflection in their eyes and say, "She can do this. Nani can do this. I can do it too."
Yeah, I think a lot of people look at politics as a thing that other people do. Like, there's a political class, like it or not, and those are the people who run and not me. Mm-hmm. Do you hope to see that change? I mean, through partly your efforts, but those of others as well?
Oh, definitely. You know, I like meeting people, whether they're here in Madison, whether they live in my district, or whether they are elsewhere. And everybody has a story and had things that they care about, and making it possible for them to think that, you know what, the things I care about matter and I can make a difference about this. You know, I've recommended lots of people participate in the Emerge program, which is a program for Democratic women who learn how to run for office, which is a program that I did in 2014. And, you know, I know lots of women who have done it as well. And they've gone from, "I just sit on the sidelines," to, "Nope, I'm running."
And I understand politics have been bipartisan in your family. Is that right?
Yes. If my dad is listening, he'll be very happy to hear me mention this. My dad is a Republican. I'm a Democrat. It leads to very spirited conversations around the dinner table. But at the end of the day, you know, he's my dad and I'm his daughter. We have that love. And when we know when to stop, and when one of us is getting upset, we're like, OK, it's time to talk about the Packers.
Well, and I mean, that's a great example, because I think a lot of people on social media in particular don't know when to stop. I mean, is there room for us to be civil to each other even when we disagree?
There has to be. I mean, we all have commonalities, you know, despite our differences, whether, you know, man versus woman, native versus non-native, Republican versus Democrat. We just all have to remember and assume best intentions from people. And that helps.
So what are you hoping to accomplish at this stage in your political career as a city alderperson?
Right now, I'm concentrated on being the best representative for my community that I can be. I really want to understand and know what my constituents care about and make sure that their concerns are raised on the city level, whether that means getting a stop sign put in at an intersection that makes people nervous, or, you know, working on a citywide policy on something. I want to be able to do that.
And I know that you're early in your first term on a common council. What's your vision? Do you have a next step in your political career in mind?
You know, I haven't really thought about a next step at this point. I really want to put my all into this and make sure that I can represent people of the 11th district the best I can.
Arvina, thanks a lot for joining us here in the studio today.
Thank you.
That was Arvina Martin, first Native American member of the Madison Common Council, and she's a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our look now at politics on the third day of our series, First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today.
Gary Bisaw joins us now. He's the chairman and a member of the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. Chairman Bisaw, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Veronica. I'm pleased and honored to be here.
I want to talk a little bit about your role as chairman. How would you describe your job?
Well, to serve as chairman of the Menominee Nation, where the Menominee Nation is a different breed of cat. We're non-public law 280, which means we're the only tribe in Wisconsin that has criminal jurisdiction over its members on our tribal lands. We also have the largest land base reservation east of the Mississippi with almost a 250,000 acres of forest. But basically my job, I serve as a spokesman and represent the tribal legislature in all of our relations with other governments, including state, federal, and other tribal. I preside at all meetings of the tribal legislature, and I appoint members to committees to the legislature. I serve as an ex officio member of all of our standing committees of the legislature. I exercise supervision over all of the committees. I'm responsible for the agenda and all the administrative details of our regular legislature meetings. And basically, I serve at the pleasure of our tribal legislature. They give me directives, and mostly via motion, resolution, or ordinance. And again, I serve at their pleasure.
And you've said that one thing that people may not understand is that the Menominee Tribe is sovereign, and what that relationship means when it comes to the state and the federal government. Can you describe what that relationship is and what it means to be sovereign?
Well, it's interesting because the Menominee Tribe, in a certain sense, is like a mini state within the state of Wisconsin. And I speak for Menominee only because we have an even bigger amount of authority than other tribes because of the non-public law 280 status, which means we set our own criminal law, we have our own jail, we have our own court system, our own parole officers, our prosecutors. So we adjudicate courses, all altercations or conflicts with tribal members within the reservation. But in the bigger picture, we know our tribal members and our land and our culture best. And we govern our people, both civilly and criminally. We follow federal law and tribal law, and not so much state law. So we basically govern ourselves, all of our own internal laws. Our tribal legislature develops. We operate by ordinance, by resolution, and by motion. And the ordinances are our laws, and the laws govern tribal members within the exterior boundaries of our reservation.
We're talking with Chairman Gary Biza right now of the Menominee Nation. And Chairman Biza, could you tell us about a typical day as chairman of the Menominee Nation?
Well, like any other leadership role, you know, there are so many meetings, whether it's with tribal members, whether it's with the department heads that I oversee. And typically, I would be dealing with my chairman's office manager. We have a tribal administrator overseeing the tribal administration for the tribe, emergency management director, finance director, human resource director, internal audit director, our lead prosecutor, and our chief of police. Typically, I meet with them at least monthly or twice a month for discussions. I also have a lot of meetings with state agencies through Executive Order 39 through Governor Doyle's administration, I believe. There was an executive order that talked about recognizing tribal governments and consulting with them on any actions currently or proposed that might impact tribal government. So many times we meet with state agencies regarding proposed actions. We also do a lot of actions, because a lot of our funding and a lot of our responsibilities relate, our trust responsibilities the federal government has with us are held with discussions and with funding with federal agencies. I also spend a lot of time at tribal events as their spokesperson for the tribe and for the tribal legislature. So the days are packed. The days are very busy. I end up doing a heck of a lot of traveling. Again, I serve at the pleasure of our tribal legislature, so they make sure that I'm busy.
Let's talk about the legislature a little bit. What role do legislators play?
Well, our tribe had adopted a constitution and bylaws that established our tribal governmental structure, and it consists of a legislative and judicial branch, and some executive within the our legislative, but we have a separate but equal legislative and judicial branch. So legislative branch has the power to enforce and make laws, you know, within the limits of the Constitution. And they can seek legal counsel, you know, subject to the approval of the Secretary of Interior, protect the land and tribal assets, negotiate with federal, state, and local governments, and again, adopt laws of a general and permanent nature. They also work with me as chair in selecting officers from among our tribal legislature for our standing committees.
Looking at the big picture now for the Menominee tribe, what are the big issues on your plate? What are you looking at addressing right now?
Well, we have several things. One of those is there environmentally. We know that, and culturally, the Aquila resources is an exploratory developmental mine company, and they are in Upper Michigan. They're from Canada, but they're proposing a mine in Upper Michigan that easily falls within the proposed, or their proposed mine falls within the ceded territory, original ceded territory of the Menominee tribe, and it's right along the Menominee River, which forms the interstate boundary waters between Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. They are proposing this huge open pit sulfide mine on the Michigan side, Upper Michigan side of the river, but the impact that that would have for that huge acid mining mine that they're proposing would destroy and alter many of our burial mounds and sacred cultural sites that are within the footprint of that proposed mine. And also it's just a matter of time. It will pollute through groundwater, through the acid in the groundwater. It'll pollute the Menominee River and Green Bay. So that's a huge issue for the Menominee tribe right now. It's one of the main issues. But part of what we're doing also is we're trying to grow the tribe through jobs, through economic development, while still doing it in a sustainable way. We're struggling to preserve and actually bring back our native Menominee language, and we continually fight to educate decision makers on tribal treaty and trust responsibilities, and struggle to maintain our tribal sovereignty to control our own people as we go forward. So there are many things. We're one of the poorest we are the poorest county in Wisconsin, but we have some of the best land and best resources in Wisconsin and almost in North America. We struggle to make sure that we can keep this beautiful land for our children and grandchildren, and at the same time make sure we have the jobs and the economic development here to make sure they have a good life.
Chairman Bizaw, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Veronica. I appreciate it.
That was Gary Bizaw, chairman of the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. You can find archived interviews, articles, slideshows, and more from the series at wpr.org/first.